Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
It's the Disruption Zone, and I'm super excited because this is probably like my favorite project that I've got going on right now. We're thinking maybe 6, possibly 8 episode multi-part series on the swamp in Washington with my good friend, Congressman Thomas Massie, who's been exposing the way the sausage is made. And maybe I shouldn't put it that way, Congressman Massie, exposing how they do business in Washington. Welcome, sir. How are you?
I'm doing great. I love this series. I'm looking forward to doing other topics, but this one is a really important one today. People know that money corrupts politics, but I don't think they understand how it corrupts politics.
Yeah, let's dive into this because kind of the topic that we're going to mill around on today is the idea of lobbyists and committee positions and how people get put on committee positions and how that's tied back to big money. Both parties like to talk a big game about big money, especially the Democrats, dark money, etc. And both are full of hypocrites when it comes to this. But let's start with maybe the connection. How beholden to lobbyists, and you and I have already gone over the ground before, lobbyists are fine. They represent right. People with legitimate issues. But it's when the money corrupts it that it becomes a problem. How beholden to lobbyists of some sort, special interests of some sort, is the average U.S. congressperson?
More than you realize. But it's not because they're worried about their next election. I mean, Leland, the lines have been drawn, the battle lines in Congress. There are 435 seats. There are 180 safe seats on one side and 180 safe seats on the other side. And the battle is only over the purple districts, right? So why is it that 360 congressmen who are safe in their seats will sell their souls to get some more money and because they don't need it to get reelected? That's the question. And here's the other thing that, you know, right out of the bat, you said lobbyists aren't necessarily the problem. I agree with that. And that may make some people mad, but I believe people have the right to hire lobbyists and have them advocate on their behalf. I mean, they're professionals at petitioning the government. But it's the structure. It's not the lobbyists' fault. It's not the congressman's fault. It's not the voters' fault. But there are a few people in D.C. that have designed the most insidious system you could imagine, and that's what I want to expose today. I mean, because these congressmen, I know there are some senators that have supposedly got rich since they got into Congress. A lot of the congressmen I know in the House side who got rich is because they married up and their wives are rich, okay? But most of the ones that I know sleep in their offices, okay? They're not driving Ferraris. They don't have yachts, and a lot of them have less money when they leave Congress than when they went in, okay? So it's not like they're lining their own pockets with the money that lobbyists are giving them. It's not like they're buying their next election with the money that the lobbyists, and not just lobbyists, but other large special interests who don't hire lobbyists are giving them. It's something else that's going on that I learned about in my first 3 months in Congress. It was like, oh, bless your little soul. You thought this worked like Schoolhouse Rock. Well, that ain't how it works. So let me tell you two stories that, you know, will open people's eyes, I think, when they hear them. The first story is probably the second day I was in Congress, I think, the day after I was sworn in. We had a vote on some gold commemorative coin. Not a gold medal, you know, not something for veterans, but a commemorative coin to raise money for a museum or something. And I thought, man, I'm up here to solve bigger problems than this. Why are we minting gold coins that you're going to see on TV, you know, advertised for some group to raise money? And I voted no against the gold coin. And a staffer came over to me on the floor of the House and sat down next to me and informed me of my mistake. And I said, well, what do you mean, my mistake? And she said, you voted no. The party is voting yes on this. And she assumed I had only been there a day. I didn't know how this works. And I said, well, I mean to vote no. And she said, well, if you want to know what's in this bill, you can go over to that table. And she pointed to the leadership table where there were some other staffers. She said, they can explain to you what's in this bill. And I said, I read the bill. That's why I'm voting no. And she looked at me as if it was the first time she'd ever heard that. And she said, well, we're not whipping the vote tonight. So tonight you can vote how you want.
Wait a
minute. And,
yeah. Whoa. Hold on. She assumed from the get-go that you were an employee of the party.
Yes. That I had already relinquished my voting card as a condition of getting elected, right? That I had given it to the party. And she was just helping me toe the party line. She was doing her job.
Wow.
And so it's a little, you know, I'm not upset at her. She still works on the Hill. Her boss has moved up and she moved up with her boss. But so that sort of opened my eyes that night. Well,
what was in that bill?
It was something Congress shouldn't be in the business of. We shouldn't use the Treasury to mint coins for fundraisers.
But what was the tie? Why was the party so adamant that everybody vote yes for it? Or was that a training? Was that a training moment for you? Was that them saying we're going to train these new freshmen?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because I didn't come in with the rest of the freshmen. I think that's how maybe. I'm like the horse that got out of the barn and they never could get back in the barn because I didn't go through freshman orientation. And here's why. The congressman before me, he said he wasn't going to run again. So a bunch of us ran for his seat and I won the primary. But after I won the primary, there's a clock that starts ticking for outgoing congressmen. You have to spend 2 years or you have to spend 1 year before outside of Congress before you can lobby. And so what the congressman before me decided was he needed to start his clock sooner so that he could get that high-paying lobbying job sooner. So he just flat out quit. He didn't even finish his term. So because he quit so that he could go make that paycheck, which, by the way, is about $500,000 a year. Like, that's starters
that's nice
for
money.
A congressman, yeah, who leaves. He wanted to get that clock started sooner. So he left, and he's still doing that job. I see him on the airplane. He's flying first class now, though, and I'm still in coach, and I'm okay with that. But he left. So in the House of Representatives, it's not like the Senate, and this is just has to do with our Constitution. Senators used to be named by their states. They were never elected by a popular election. Mm-hmm. So the state can still name a senator to the seat if it opens up and before they have another election. But in the House of Representatives, the seat is vacant until the people have another election. Like, even the governor can't fill the seat.
Right.
It's kind of neat. Well, anyway, they decided to save money in Kentucky. They would have a special election in November on the same day as the regular election.
Okay.
And so I was on the ballot twice. You could vote for me twice. Once for the 6 week term that would start right after the November election and end on January 3rd.
Right.
And then once from January 3rd onward for 2 years. The reason I'm telling you all that is to explain how I got out of the brainwashing that happens because I came in right after the election and I started voting. Well, the other people who won in the November election, they had 6 weeks of orientation that they went to. I was literally on the floor voting. I couldn't go to orientation. They hauled them like up to Harvard, you know, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to teach them about government and all this other stuff. And I missed all that. So I missed the orientation.
Wow.
And that's probably a good thing because I never did comply. I always sort of had the Schoolhouse Rock version of how government was supposed to work.
It's what we all thought.
So
now I interrupted you. I interrupted you to chase this rabbit trail. You were about to say that after she came and told you that how you were supposed to vote, that a few months later, and that's where we let's jump back.
Yeah, this
to that.
Is the part. Now this is the story. A few months later, that people are going to say, is Congressman Massey, is he making all that up? Because I think he might be making that up. But Leland, I've been telling this story now for 7 years, and nobody, and especially the ones in Washington, D.C., have said that I'm making it up. They know it's all true. They know it's happened. I even had a lobbyist come up to me, because this story involves a lobbyist, and he said, let me guess the lobbyist who made that indecent proposal to you, because I haven't outed the lobbyist ever. I've never uttered his name. He still works in Washington, D.C. And this other lobbyist guessed the name of the lobbyist who did what I'm about to tell you in this story. So a few months later, after this first vote, I get invited to the basement of the Capitol Hill Club. Now, there's a bar and a grill down there, and I hang out there. I'll just be, you know, totally up front. And that's where you go to meet lobbyists. You typically don't meet them in your office, because if there's money involved and you have that meeting in your office, you're breaking the House rules. You may even be breaking the law. You're using government property to conduct, to solicit campaign money. That's not allowed. So what they've done is they set up a building that is, you cross the street. You literally walk out of your office, cross the street, and now you're in the safe spot where you can conduct this business and you can talk to lobbyists about money or legislation.
This sounds very similar. This sounds very similar to during the Obama administration. They were trying to avoid having records of who was coming and going from the White House. So they were meeting at the Starbucks across the street. It wasn't technically a visit to the White House. It was White House staffers meeting with people across the street for coffee.
Well, listen, I and by the way, I'm glad this building exists, because I wouldn't want to be doing this from my office. By the way, there's another building next to it called the NRCC, National Republican Congressional Committee, and I'm persona non grata there. I can't even go in that building because, well, we might get to that
okay,
later.
Yeah, I'm marking that on my post-it note here. You're coming back to why you can't go into the National Republicans. I'm marking that down.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So sometimes you may see a congressman sitting in his car making phone calls and doing business on the street. That is me, because I can't go into the Republican building to do it because, well, we'll get to that later. But I am a member in good standing at the Capitol Hill Club, okay? And I go to I was going to the basement to meet with the lobbyists, and most congressmen in D.C., everyone that I know of, has a fundraiser, a person who helps you collect the money that the lobbyists may want to give to you.
Okay.
And again, I don't want to act like I don't like lobbyists. I don't want to act like I don't take their money. I mean, I wish they would give me more. Frankly, I'm one of the worst fundraisers in D.C. in terms of collecting some of this money. And if they would give me more, I would take it but I wouldn't give it to the NRCC, and that's why they don't let me in there. But anyway, we'll get to that later. My D.C. fundraiser, very, very nice lady, she arranged a meeting for me with three lobbyists in the basement of the Capitol Hill Club. And there's no windows, by the way, in the basement of the Capitol Hill Club. Nobody can see
That's
what's
convenient.
Going on in there. And I'm there with my chief of staff, who came with me. He's my best friend. I met him in college. So instead of hiring like some political animal, I hired my best friend from college. I'm like, he's the one guy that won't sell me out as my chief of staff. So he's down in the basement with me. We're with this fundraiser and three lobbyists. And the lobbyist starts telling me, he says, listen, he said, you guys are too smart to be doing what you're doing. You're stuck on the Transportation Committee and the Oversight Committee and the Science Committee. He's like, those are C committees. Those are B committees. You need to be on an A committee. And frankly, we think you're special. You know, you're an engineer, and your chief of staff is an engineer. You're not like the rest of these people. And I'm feeling like, you know, Britney Spears, like I'm being recruited for a new album or something, you know, that he's recognized some talent here, right? And I'm actually, you have to suppress the feeling inside you, you know, wow, this guy really appreciates, you know, what I'm trying to do. And so he sort of reeling the line in, right? And then he says, now, the Ways and Means Committee is the most powerful committee here in Congress, and you need to be on that committee. And some of these guys are going to screw up. They're not going to, you know, win their next election. They're going to get caught doing stuff. You know, there's always three or four openings every Congress on the Ways and Means Committee. And he said, and we've got it on good authority, wink, wink, nod, nod, that Paul Ryan is going to be the next chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. Now, Paul Ryan did become the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and he then later became the Speaker of the House. But it was the lobbyists who knew this was going to happen before anybody else.
Right.
Okay.
Wow.
Now, I'm wondering, does he have a crystal ball? I've not heard this from anybody. How does he know Paul Ryan will be the next chairman of the Ways and Means Committee? And then he says to me, you need to be on the Ways and Means Committee. And he points to the other two lobbyists with him. And he says, my friends and I are prepared to raise the money that's going to be required to get you on that committee.
To get you on that committee.
To get you on that committee.
So you have to pay to get on the committee.
It's about $1 million.
What?
Yes.
To who?
You collect it. Now you can. It's hard to go back to your congressional district and have a fundraiser in somebody's living room, and say, hey, I need you all to all donate $50 because I need to raise $1 million to get on this
committee. Right.
Right. Right. That doesn't work so well. So you typically, it's like a beauty contest. You have to go through everything but the swimsuit contest.
We'll skip that with Congress. I don't. There's not very many Congress members that I want to see in a bathing suit. So.
No. Washington, D.C. is Hollywood for ugly people. So there's everything but the swimsuit contest,
right,
and capturing the attention of the lobbyists who have business in front of those committees.
Right.
Okay. You literally, to get on a committee, here's what I found out. You need lobbyists to make recommendations to the chairman on your behalf that you should be on that committee. But more importantly, you have to prove that you are ready to raise the money to rent your seat on that committee. Now, earlier, I told you it's about $1 million to get on the Ways and Means Committee. That's, you don't buy your seat. There's no equity. You rent it. Like, you have to raise probably $500,000 at least every election cycle for the party in order to stay on the Ways and Means Committee.
So
they want to make sure. Yeah. And my point was, most of that you're going to have to raise in Washington, D.C. from the people who have business in front of the committee.
You have to go to lobbyists, get them to give you donations, take those donations and give them to who?
Hello?
Hey, so the NSA cut us off because I go, you got to take those donations and give them to who? And it goes, neat, neat, neat.
Okay.
Well, I'm leaving that in. That's awesome. I'm leaving that in. All right. So the question I asked you was, you have to raise $1 million from the lobbyists, which you take and give to who? And again, these lobbyists are the ones who are dictating who gets the invite. Then you go raise the money for them. The money goes to who?
Well, you're supposed to take the money over to the NRCC.
Okay.
And now you understand why the NRCC doesn't let me in the building.
Because you won't do it.
Because I don't pay what they euphemistically call your assessment or your dues. Like your dues are basically the price you pay to rent your committee seat. And if you fall into arrears, there are lots of people who will try to help you catch up.
Right.
And, you know, pay now and get half off your dues, or, you know, there are all sorts of special offers I've found. It's like when you cancel your newspaper subscription. Yeah. When you cancel your newspaper subscription, eventually they'll sell it to you for 5 cents, you know, a paper or something.
Right.
So then let me tell you, like, I started out thinking that I would pay my dues. okay? Because, you know, one of the congressmen who I respect, when I got there, he said, look, just pay your dues, give them the money they want, and then vote how you want, right?
Right.
They won't give you half as much grief about your vote if you just give them the money. And so some of the conservatives up there, and my hat's off to them, do pay their dues on time and in full. And then they go vote, you know, how they want to vote.
Right.
And by the way, so what the NRCC does with this money is they try to get us back in the majority. Like, I think that's actually a good thing, right?
Right, laudable.
If we're in the minority. Yeah. And if we're in the majority, they try to keep us in the majority.
Right.
So what they do is they take the money that they've collected from the, let's say, 180 Republicans who are in safe seats and don't need a lot of money. They take that money, pool it together, and then do independent expenditures for the congressmen who are in vulnerable districts.
Right.
Or independent expenditures against the Democrats who are vulnerable, and maybe we could take that seat back. Now, the Democrats do the exact same thing. It's called the DCCC.
Okay.
And they charge rent on the committees, just like the Republicans do. And then they take that money and they spend it on about 80 races, 80 races, because that's where the battle, line is.
Right, the purple districts. Those are
the purple districts. Now, here's where the problem, you can already see a couple issues with this system. It's pay, number one, it's pay to play. So
you got to
collect the money from the people who have business in front of your committee. Those are the ones most interested in contributing to you, right?
Right.
So just to be like totally upfront with you, I serve on the transportation committee, okay? There are some lobbyists interested in the transportation committee and the business we have in front of the transportation committee. And some of them will give me money because they appreciate the work I do, or maybe even if I don't vote for the things they want, they still want me to take their phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
And so they will give money. Or maybe they have members who support me, even if their organization doesn't. And the members would start to say, why aren't you helping out Massey? He, like,
right.
We really like that guy.
Right.
So I'm not trying to say, again, that I don't take lobbyist money or that the lobbyists and that are interested in my committee don't give money. But the reality of the fact is the transportation is like 1% of the federal budget, whereas the Ways and Means Committee controls the tax code, which is 100% of the federal budget,
right,
minus the deficit,
right.
Okay? So you can see how it's basically 100 times more powerful because everybody cares about the tax code.
The problem I'm seeing emerge here is that you raise the money from the people that are interested in have business in front of those committees so that you can sit on that committee, which creates a conflict of interest. Because if you don't do what those people who have business in front of the committee do want you to do, then they won't give you money, which was what will keep you on that seat. So it's a circular conflict of interest that never really ends unless you have somebody willing to buck the system like yourself who votes your conscience as opposed to the way the lobbyists tell you to vote.
And there's another thing that can happen to the money that's flowing from the lobbyists to the congressman. The Speaker of the House, you know, back when John Boehner was the Speaker of the House, it was rumored, I don't have any evidence, they're too smart to write this down, had a blacklist, okay, and circulated that to lobbyists. Now, not all the lobbyists followed the blacklist, but some of them did. And the lobbyists were told, if you give money to anybody on this list, you know, you might get yourself through committee, but it ain't going to come to the floor of the House of Representatives because the Speaker of the House, who is the fundraiser in chief, the Speaker of the House, whether it's Republican or Democrat, typically raises $80 million. Like, if you think a rank and file seat on Ways and Means Committee is expensive, wait till you see the price tag on if you want to be Speaker of the House, right?
Right.
It's like $80 million an election cycle. But the Speaker of the House has the power to tell those lobbyists, even if you're voting as the committee would want you to vote, if you don't at the end of the day, for instance, vote for a war, or you don't vote for an omnibus, or, you know, this, or a debt limit increase, the speaker can go back and tell the lobbyist, quit giving to Massey because he's causing me grief and I don't want any more grief. And you're just enabling him. So, and none of your business will come in front of the whole House if you keep enabling him. So that's the other thing that can happen to your money that's flowing from the lobbyist.
So
now,
so were you on the speaker's blacklist? I mean, theoretically, allegedly?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Look, go look at my finance reports, okay? The year that I raised the most money inside of D.C. among the lobbyists was the first year I was in office.
Wow.
And it's like, it looks like radioactive decay. Like it got cut in half for the second year. And then it got cut in half from that number the next year. And it's been on a pretty steady decline.
But again, so people understand, that's not money that would have gone to your reelection efforts. That's money from lobbyists in order to pay your way to sit on these committees versus the money that the average person gives you, which is what you're allowed to, which is what you use to be reelected, to run your campaign with. So, so you're a congressman. Go ahead.
Just backing up, I don't need the money to get reelected in a general election.
Right.
Nor do 360 representatives, whether they're Democrat or Republican. They are in districts that are so red or so blue, they don't have to worry about their general election. But there's this other thing called a primary where you can lose. And by the way, the NRCC and the DCCC don't help you at least or hurt you in ways that can be traced easily in primaries. But they will work against you in the primary. They'll take their apparatus and use it against you. But sorry, I interrupted.
No, I was just trying to, like, so that people understand. So your thing is you just don't play the game. And you're exposing how the game is played. That's the reason why you can't go into the NRCC building, because you don't pay those dues?
Well, that's right. And they would say, well, there are resources in this building, and if you come in and use them without giving us money, then you've committed a campaign violation. Now, the resources I would use would be like a telephone.
Right,
you know,
right.
Like, and a printer. They don't amount to $300,000 every election cycle, which, is, by the way, is my assessment. That is the amount of dues they expect me to pay.
Right.
And I can tell you right now, as I'm talking to you, in the last 7 years, so, you know, they want me to pay $150,000 a year. Let me do that math here. That would be over $1 million I owe them.
Mm-hmm.
I have given them $6,000 in the 7 years that I've been there, and they wanted $1 million.
Well, that should pay for a phone call, though.
Well, it should, but I'd like to have the $6,000 back. Like, it was the first, it was before that lobbyist offered me the money to raise the money that would be required to get me on the Ways and Means Committee.
Right.
Before I really realized how this all worked, they came to me and they said, you know, your assessment is $32,000 this quarter, or maybe it's $24,000. I forget what it was. And they're like, you know, you're already 2 months into this quarter, Massey. We want to help you out. We don't want you to get behind. We've got a special deal this week only. If you'll come to the March fundraising dinner, which is the biggest fundraiser they have in Washington, D.C., and they bring up their high rollers, like their millionaires, the folks who can give like $130,000 to the committee.
Right.
They said, if you'll come to the dinner and sit at one of these tables, because they'd like to have a congressman at every table. If you'll come to the dinner and sit at one of these tables, we've got like $10,000 of unallocated PAC money that we will put in your name toward the NRCC assessment. And then we've got a two-for-one deal. Every dollar you give us from your campaign account will match with a dollar. And I was like, so you mean I can be out of this? It was either $24,000 or $32,000. I can be out of this onerous commitment if I just give you $6,000? And they're like, yes, $6,000 and come to the dinner. I said, deal. And I gave him $6,000, and I went to the dinner, and I felt pretty good. I met my assessment for first 3 months of Congress. Well, you know, this one thing led to another. I voted against John Boehner. I got taken off my committee. I was still on the committee, but they had made me a chairman of the research committee, which is a subcommittee of the Science, Space, and Technology Committee. So literally, Leland, the 6 weeks after I came to Congress, I had a gavel in my hand, sitting in the chairman's seat, running a subcommittee hearing in the Science Committee. And within 3 months, that gavel was gone. You know, and I had to reprint all of my stationery. I didn't do a press release back in the district, you know, that I and the way they did it was so polite. I never really held it against the chairman of the Science Committee. He came to me and he said, you know, we need to merge the research committee with the technology committee, and we're going to call it the Research and Technology Committee. And Larry Bouchon is going to be the chairman of this new committee, and you can be like the decorative vice chairman or something like that.
Wow.
And I said, they thought I would be mad. And I was like, wow, if you merge two committees, you'll need less staff. You'll have better attendance. We'll save money. It sounds like a good deal all around. Right. And they were like, wait, you're not mad? It's like, no, this is slimming things down. Let's just do this. But anyway, so, by the way,
go ahead.
Before we go back to the thread on why another reason this is all bad, the system, the way the system's set up, not all bad, but another reason it's bad. 2 years later, just jumping ahead, the same chairman of the same science committee, his name's Lamar Smith. He's since retired, so he won't mind me telling this, I don't think. He came to me and he said, Thomas, I want to make you the chairman of the merged committees. This is 2 years after, you know, they did this maneuver to take away my gavel. And he said, you know, you're from MIT. You've got two engineering degrees. There's nobody more suited to be the chairman of the Research and Technology Committee on the Science, Space, and Technology Committee. And this was in December. And it was just me and him in a closed room. And I said, Mr. Chairman, in 4 weeks, I'm going to vote against John Boehner again. And they're going to come to you and ask you to take this gavel back away from me. And I'll have to reprint all that letterhead again and do another press release. I said, do you remember how embarrassing and how awkward that was for me and you? And he said, yes. I said, go give this gavel to somebody else.
What did he say?
And he said, in all my years, I've never had anybody be that honest with me and that direct. And then like he was stunned for about 5 seconds. And then he asked me how many more of us were voting against John Boehner because we needed 29. Right.
Right.
And actually we ended up getting 24, but 9 months later we came up with another idea and got rid of John Boehner.
Right.
I told him, I said, Mr. Chairman, I felt obligated to tell you that I am voting against John Boehner because of our, you know, friendship. I said, but I do not feel obligated to tell you anything more about this coup.
Right. I love it.
So, okay. I had to jump 2 years ahead.
Yeah, real quick. I want to go back to, don't lose your place because I want to jump back to the dinner you were talking about. This literally sounds like a casino and escorts given to the high rollers because it's people that are wanting influence. They want to be seen sitting at the powerful so-and-so's table. So, I mean, forgive the analogy, but is that not essentially what we're talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
I just wanted to clarify that.
I don't like the analogy.
Because you've assigned all the roles properly in your analogy, which makes me the prostitute. it makes the NRCC or the fundraisers, the madams, right?
Right.
The ones that are organizing this.
Right.
And it makes the donors the Johns, right?
Right.
Like, so I don't like the analogy because basically in this analogy, I am the prostitute, but carrying your analogy further, The reason I raised so much money the first year in Congress is I would show them a little leg, but I never let them touch the goods. So they're like, you're the most miserable prostitute like we've ever had. Like, you know, the eye candy is good, but anyway. Can you imagine, like, now if you went to the March dinner, you gave the NRCC $132,000 and your wife gave the NRCC $132,000 and you went to the March dinner and you sat down and you looked at, and your escort was Thomas Massey.
Right, you'd be like, what did I do? This guy, he doesn't have any influence.
although, honestly, I will tell you, Leland, some of the people who give don't really want influence.
Right.
But there are altruistic donors who are conservatives that believe in the
cause. They just want the cause, right. And like you were saying, NRCC is not all – some of what they're doing is good, because if you don't have what they're doing, we don't have a shot at getting into the majority with conservatives. It's not entirely bad. I think the point of this is just to expose how the system works and how it loops the voter out of it.
Right. And the reason, I was being self-deprecating about going to the March dinner, but honestly, if these big donors go to the March dinner and they don't see any conservatives like Thomas Massey or Jim Jordan or Mark Meadows, they right. start to wonder, are they giving their money in the right place?
Right. They have to have a few of you guys as window dressing so that they know they're in the presence of some kind of semblance of a conservative movement.
Exactly right, because that's what a lot of them are giving in the name of. So let me tell you the other really broken thing about this system.
Okay.
Okay. You pile up all the money that everybody can raise in your party. With the Republicans give it to the NRCC. The Democrats give it to the DCCC. By the way, Leland, I give money to my colleagues, but I give it directly to them. If I don't have a tough race and I've got a little extra money kicking around in the account, and they got a tough, election, whether it's a primary or a general, and I know they're a good person and that America depends on them, I write a check from my campaign directly to theirs. Right. I don't run it through the NRCC. Okay. Because here's the problem. When you pile all the money up, all the bounty that everybody can collect, and you give it basically to the Speaker of the House. Now, it would be the minority leader if you're in the minority. But that's the person who's understood to control that money. Mm-hmm. Now, they go out there and they do good things with it. They back congressmen in these tough races to win. I mean, they may spend $10 million on one race, okay, that the candidate alone could have never raised themselves. But the problem is they're looking for compliant candidates. You know, whereas the military is looking for a few good men and women, the parties are looking for as many compliant candidates as they can find, ones who will do what they're told when they get there. But whether you're compliant or not, whether you mean to be compliant, maybe they've got a great conservative in a tough district and they give them $5 million in their race and they win by the slimmest of margins. Okay. That congressman comes to Washington, D.C. And then when the speaker comes up, or the minority leader, if you're in the minority, and says, hey, we really need your help on this vote. You can vote how you want, 90% of the time, but on this omnibus bill, we got to get to 218. You're part of that. We helped you out. We need you to help us out. And the person is thinking back to their election that cost $10 million to win, and, $5 million of it was given by the NRCC, and they won by, 1%. They really have a hard time breaking free of that request from the leadership.
Right.
So that's another way this system, which is, a lot of people participate in it because ostensibly it's designed to do good things.
Right.
It gives too much power to in concentrated areas, and that's a problem.
So we've got about 5 minutes here, and I know you have to move on. But in terms of just sort of wrapping up this conversation, what do you think is the solution? Because I'm in agreement with you. Lobbyists aren't necessarily in and of themselves bad things. Certainly the organizations that push forward a political party's prospects are not bad. Certainly not everything that's being done is bad. The problem is, though, that there seems to be this ability to create conflicts of interest, ability to concentrate power in certain areas that shifts it away from the average American. How do we fix this?
Okay, I've got about three ideas. One we can just copy from the state legislatures, and this wouldn't fix everything overnight. But for instance, in the state of Kentucky, if you're in the state house or the state senate, you can't raise money. You can't hold a fundraiser during session. While the legislature is in session, you cannot solicit money.
Okay.
And that does a couple of things. One, it actually makes it harder on incumbents. It takes away some of that incumbent advantage, which because if you're not in the legislature, you can raise money whenever you want. So that sort of balances the power back out from the incumbents to the challengers. So people wouldn't readily do that. It keeps you from being distracted during the session. Maybe you'll have time to read the bills instead of, you know, going from rushing from one fundraiser to another.
Right.
But what I'm told, the biggest result of it is it shortens the session.
Less laws.
Right. Because everybody wants to end the session and go raise their money.
Yeah.
That's an idea that I think has some merit and it works in the States. Here's an idea that I don't know if it's practical and but it's completely counterintuitive.
Okay.
People want transparency in the money, right? They say, okay, anybody can give to anybody, but at least let's know who's giving to somebody so we can reveal that. I can tell you as somebody who's in the hot seat, who presses the voting button, who I'll be, you know, at the State of the Union tomorrow night, and I'll be voting the day after that. It's hard in your own mind, and don't think less of me for saying this. I'm just telling you human nature.
Sure.
Not to have in the back of your mind when you vote, who gave me money?
Uh-huh.
Right?
Right.
You don't forget that. And I'd like to think it doesn't influence my vote, but I know humans are humans. And even, you know, if it was just a small amount, it saved you. Let's say somebody gives you $5,000. What does that mean? That means that saves you like a day on the telephone of calling up people like a telemarketer and begging for money, right?
Right, right.
They literally gave you, not that they bought influence or something, but it's hard not to appreciate the fact they just saved you a day on the telephone of begging for money, right? So here's what I'm getting to. Anonymize the money, right? So that one of those people who gave me $5,000, if they come up and say, I just gave $5,000 into this randomized, you know, Bitcoin account, and I can't prove that I gave it to you, but I did, trust me, wink, wink, nod, nod. Well, the bum on the street can tell me the same thing.
Right.
Or somebody at a town hall could say, you know, I gave you $5,000. I can't believe you're going to take the microphone away from me right now.
Right, right.
You know, I can't believe you won't give me your cell number. Well, nobody has a way to prove whether they really gave the money or not because it goes through a fund that like hides the source of the money.
Right. So that's actually counterintuitive to what everybody else is saying is make it transparent because they want to intimidate people to not be involved in the process versus you saying give all you want, but don't let the giving intimidate or coerce the voters.
Right, because then you're not taking away their First Amendment right to spend money on elections. But let me tell you what I think one of the real answers could be here, Leland, and is if we had, you'd almost need both parties to agree to disarm at the same time, because this would be like a House rule or a conference rule. If the Speaker of the House wasn't the fundraiser in chief, okay, if the chairman of the committees weren't, you know, miniature fundraisers in chiefs. If you agreed by virtue of becoming a chairman of a committee or a speaker of the House or the majority whip or the minority whip or the floor leader of either party that you would not attend a fundraiser, if you would give up your fundraising power in order to take that position of power,
right,
that would probably have the biggest effect that I can imagine. And it's not restraining Leland Conway's ability to write a check to any candidate, right?
Right.
It's just saying, okay, let's just say, you know what? You've got such an important job. And by the way, those jobs pay more. If you are in leadership, like if you're Speaker of the House, you get a higher salary than other congressmen.
Right.
This job is so important that, you know what? You're just not going to have time to fundraise. And even if it weren't a law, maybe you feel like that's unconstitutional to have a law that makes that happen, or you don't want to send somebody to jail if they slip up. Just make it a promise and make it in the rules
right.
of each party.
Right.
And then you could maybe bring some semblance of common sense and lack of, you would get some of these conflicts of interest out, or right. the sense of obligation that every member has to the Speaker or the Chairman if they help them get reelected.
I think part of the problem with all of these ideas is that they all involve, like, similar to term limits, they involve self-policing. And our great experiment was about self-government, and yet our very own government can't police itself.
Yeah, it's a problem. I don't know how you solve it, but the first step in solving it, Leland, is to explain to the people what the problem is.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people I know feel like money corrupts politics, right? But and they ask for things, ridiculous things, like publicly funded elections. Okay. The problem with publicly funded elections is now CNN is effectively the biggest political arm in the country,
yeah.
or Fox News, right?
Right.
You're not going to take away their right to talk about elections and candidates, but you're going to take away the candidates' rights to advertise in a newspaper or on radio. So I think publicly funded elections are a bad idea, but congressmen aren't buying yachts and Ferraris with money from lobbyists. It doesn't happen. You would go to jail if it did. Okay.
Right.
A lot of them are sleeping on their couch in their offices, and not getting richer, but getting poorer. And I'm not asking you to feel sorry for them. I'm just saying that's not where the money's flowing.
Right.
But the money goes into this system that's evolved over the last 100 years that rewards people for being compliant. Mm-hmm. The system is set out to do good things for each party, but it ends up giving certain people too much power, and the lobbyists recognize this and are eager to participate in it. I don't blame them for playing in it. I don't blame the congressmen who cooperate with it.
Right.
Some days I feel guilty that I'm not giving to the NRCC and that they're trying to keep us in the majority. I assuage that guilt by giving money directly to other candidates.
Right, right. It's like there's a maybe the congressmen don't have the money in hand, but there's these swirling of influences around them, and they try to shift it because they just want to maintain power. They want to maintain their position. They want to maintain
right.
that position of specialness in society and that sense of power. And so it becomes a, you talked about human nature earlier. It becomes the natural thing to do. It makes sense.
Yeah.
By way of promotion, what are we going to tackle the next episode?
You know, I would like to talk about food freedom.
Oh, yes.
And how the big companies love regulations that keep small farmers down.
You know, I think there's only like 10 companies that basically own like 99% of the food we eat. It's insane.
There are only like 4 meat packers in the country that, control 90%. And if you look at the dairy industry, you're going to see a similar conglomeration. And what's happened is farmers are going out of business. They're going bankrupt. More of the food is coming from overseas. The big companies are doing fine. The price of cropland is going up. There are more chemicals in your food. The safety isn't improving. The nutrition isn't improving. Yet the government's getting more involved.
Yeah.
And I would like to unpack all of that in our next podcast.
Consider it done. All right. One last thing before I let you go. I know we're running over here. Reaction to the fact that the impeachment bid by the Democrats seems to have failed.
Well, Nancy Pelosi said it should be bipartisan. The only thing bipartisan about it has been the opposition to it. In the House, every Republican voted against it, and Democrats joined us.
Yeah.
And in the Senate, I think you're going to see every Republican vote against impeachment, and Democrats will join them. And so what I hope is the backlash will be so obvious from this that the next president, whether it's Republican or Democrat, doesn't have to go through this sham.
Yeah.
And I hope that President Trump is reelected. I'll be working to make that happen. And I hope they don't try to do this again on him. I hope they learn their lesson. I hope they lose the majority in the House. I hope we keep our majority in the Senate. I hope Trump gets reelected. And I hope they are willing to move on to real things like transportation infrastructure and things people want us to work on.
Important things to the American people. Congressman Massey, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Leland. This has been fun, as always.
All right. That's episode 2 of the Disruption Zone special podcast series with Congressman Thomas Massey. Thomas Massey and the D.C. Swamp Monster, trying to clear up what goes on in the swamp that President Trump and others are trying to drain. Pretty interesting and informative stuff. We will cover the food freedom and much more with Congressman Massey as this series goes on. Lots more coming from Disruption Zone this week. Make sure you dial in on Instagram. It's at the Disruption Zone. And also I'm there at Great Lelando. And on Twitter, it's Zone Disruption, at Zone Disruption. And of course, I'm on Twitter at Leland Show. I just need 97 followers to hit 5,000. So help me out with that. Thanks again to Dynamics Productions for their help with the production on this program. I love all of y'all. And check out the website, thedisruptionzone.com. You can comment. And feel free, by the way, to text me or to shoot me, rather, shoot me a tweet in the DMs or an Instagram and tell me what topics you would like us to cover on The Disruption Zone. Thanks for listening. I'm Leland Conway.